The opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Murderish podcast. Sensitive topics are discussed. Listener discretion is advised.
When two people meet, it's exciting when there's a mutual, instant affection for one another. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's special. On rare occasions, however, a seemingly special human connection can actually be a bad thing, and in even more rare instances, it can lead to deadly consequences. The case we're examining today begs the question, would someone have died if two people had not had the opportunity to meet? In 1954, a murder case out of New Zealand shocked the world due in part to the highly unlikely perpetrators. And though it was easily solved, a striking revelation about the case didn't fully come to light until 40 years later. This is Jamie, and you're listening to Murderish. Join me in examining the dark, twisted tale of victim Honora Parker. This case takes us to Christchurch, New Zealand, the largest city in the South Island area of the country. It's New Zealand's second most populated city behind Auckland. In the 1950s, Christchurch was considered an incredibly wholesome city. The Sydney Morning Herald described it as New Zealand's quietest, most Victorian English city, a cathedral city of bicycles, lace, and old ivy. It was probably the last place you'd expect a cold-blooded murder to happen, but violence can find a home anywhere. What happened in 1954 upended what the public knew about Christchurch and the kind of people who lived there. As it turned out, the perpetrators of this violent crime weren't even natives of New Zealand. Both individuals were British nationals, two transplants who were arguably fated to meet. Honora Parker was a loyal woman who lived under a veil of secrecy. Few people in her life were aware that she wasn't married to Herbert Reaper, the man she had four children with. It was extremely taboo in the 1950s to have children out of wedlock, so only adults in their immediate family knew the truth. Because of this veil of secrecy, some people referred to Honora as Mrs. Parker. Many more people knew her as Mrs. Reaper. When she was 18, Honora emigrated from England to New Zealand with her mother. Several years later, Honora met Herbert Reaper, an accountant at the firm where she worked. Though Herbert was 15 years older, Honora developed a strong attachment to him. To make sense of the age gap, Honora's mother speculated she was trying to fill the role of a father figure in her life. In the early 1930s, Herbert and Honora moved in together and began living as husband and wife. By 1936, the couple had relocated to Christchurch. It seemed like a wonderful place to raise a family, which was something Honora had always wanted. Tragedy came with the birth of Honora and Herbert's first child. Their baby boy was born with serious cardiopulmonary defects, and he only survived for a few months. There were happier times with a second child. Their daughter Wendy Parker was born in March of 1937. The following year, Herbert and Honora welcomed another daughter into the world. Their third child, Pauline Yvonne Parker, was born in May 1938. Pauline was born healthy, but at 5 years old, she fell gravely ill with osteomyelitis, a bone marrow infection that causes painful swelling. In modern times, the illness can be treated with antibiotics and often has a favorable prognosis. But in a time when antibiotics weren't widely available, Pauline's condition could be life-threatening or lead to permanent physical impairment. She survived the infection, but it resulted in her walking with a slight limp. Herbert and Honora's fourth child, Rosemary Parker, was born in March 1949. At the time of Rosemary's birth, Honora was 40 years old and Herbert was 54. It was a high-risk pregnancy for Honora to conceive later in life, and Rosemary was born with Down syndrome. In those days, it was common to institutionalize someone with an intellectual disability. For many, it was easier to hide away those with developmental or intellectual disabilities, even young children. At just 2 years old, Rosemary was sent to a colony known as Templeton Farm, where she was supposedly under constant care. Her family visited regularly and sometimes took her home for short stays. Like many similar American institutions, it would later come to light that Templeton Farm concealed widespread abuse. It's also been suggested that the facility was part of New Zealand's controversial eugenics movement, the practice of mating people with desirable hereditary traits in order to optimize the human species. For Honora and Herbert, Templeton Farm likely provided a sense of relief from the financial stress of having a child with special needs. The Canterbury Regional Council paid for all of Rosemary's care, as long as she was kept inside the institution's walls. Honora and Herbert were not financially well off by any means. Their home was located within walking distance of Canterbury College, which allowed them to take in student boarders for extra money. Herbert's line of work at that time was relatively lucrative. He managed a wholesale fish business 2 blocks from the family home. His paychecks and rent payments from boarders were their sole sources of income. Conflicts over money fueled many arguments between Herbert and Honora. Somehow, their relationship of more than 2 decades always survived. Herbert and Honora's second oldest daughter, Pauline, seemed troubled from a young age. She was prone to constant daydreaming, and she didn't make friends easily. That all changed when she met Juliet Hume. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As a parent, we know the importance of teaching our children about money early on. Greenlight is your super easy solution for family finance management. With Greenlight, you'll have a powerful debit card and money app at your fingertips, designed specifically for families like yours. Send instant money transfers to your kids, receive real-time spending notifications, and effortlessly manage chores and allowances, all in one convenient place. Imagine seeing the joy of your kids' faces light up after they get money deposited directly into their accounts for completing household tasks, instilling valuable lessons on hard work and financial independence from a young age gives our kids a jumpstart on adulting successfully later on. If my parents had the Greenlight app when I was growing up, I'm sure they would have gotten responses to chores with a lot less attitude from me. With Greenlight, your kids will learn to earn, save, and spend wisely, while also building financial literacy and independence. And with the innovative in-app financial literacy game Level Up, they'll have fun while mastering money management skills through engaging videos, challenges, and mini games. Let's face it, turning a financial literacy tool into a game is genius if you want to motivate kids to engage with it. Join the millions of parents and kids already using Greenlight to empower the next generation with the knowledge and confidence to make responsible financial choices. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/murderish. That's greenlight.com/murderish to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/murderish. Juliet Marion Hume was born in London in October 1938. She was the eldest of Hilda and Henry Hume's 2 children. Juliet's brother Jonathan was born 5 years after her. The Humes were incredibly wealthy. Dr. H.R. Hume, as Henry was known professionally, was a highly respected mathematical physicist. While working as a mathematics lecturer at the University of Liverpool in 1936, Dr. Hume met Hilda Marion Reevely. They had a brief courtship and got married in early 1937. Not long after their wedding, Dr. Hume accepted the position of chief assistant at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England. During his two-year tenure in this role, he elevated his professional reputation by publishing several articles in scientific journals. Suddenly, World War II broke out. Dr. Hume was pulled into war efforts where his skills were most needed. In 1940, he began work as chief scientist in the degaussing department, which focused on mine design. 2 years later, Dr. Hume was promoted to deputy director of operational research of the Admiralty, which commanded the Royal Navy at the time. Once the war ended, the doctor was appointed scientific advisor to the British Air Ministry. The decision to emigrate to New Zealand was not taken lightly. At 40 years old, Dr. Hume had built an illustrious career in his home country. It's likely his career would have progressed to upper-level positions in mathematical physics if he'd stayed. His daughter Juliet was the deciding factor. As a young girl, Juliet Hume was diagnosed with tuberculosis, or TB, an upper respiratory disease that attacks the lungs. In the 1940s, a warm climate with clean air was considered the best course of treatment. When her illness relapsed, Juliet was shipped out to sanitariums in the Caribbean and South Africa. While Juliet was away on one of her treatment excursions, Dr. Hume spotted an ad that caught his attention. The advertisement invited applications for the position of rector at Canterbury University College in Christchurch, New Zealand. If Dr. Hume moved the entire family to New Zealand, maybe Juliet could avoid being sent away for treatment. Compared to England, New Zealand's climate was warm, sunny, and had fresh, clean air, which was thought to be the best environment for someone with TB. To Dr. Hume, relocating to New Zealand seemed like a great option. It was a decision he'd come to deeply regret. In 1948, the Hume family arrived in Christchurch. As part of Dr. Hume's university compensation, the family was housed in a lavish 16-room mansion known as Islam Homestead. The two-story stone building rests upon a garden landscape on the university grounds. In the next few years, the Humes hosted extravagant parties at the sprawling mansion, with some of the world's leading scientists as their guests. The Humes also purchased a seaside cottage in Port Levy, a short 35-mile drive south of Christchurch. Hilda Hume, Juliet's mother, adjusted well to life in Christchurch. She was a natural socialite who enjoyed the social perks of being the rector's wife at a highly regarded university. Hilda also became heavily involved in the community. Back in her native England, she'd worked as a marriage counselor and continued some of that same work abroad. In New Zealand, Mrs. Hume joined the Christchurch Marriage Guidance Council and was elected vice president of the Canterbury Council of Social Services on two occasions. Life in Christchurch was relatively peaceful for the Humes, but Juliet's chronic illness didn't seem to improve much. At one point, she was sent to northern New Zealand to attend boarding school close to a sanitarium that could treat her tuberculosis. She remained at the boarding school for less than a year before reuniting with her family in Christchurch. Juliet attended Christchurch Girls High School, and in 1952, at the age of 15, she found herself in the same class as 16-year-old Pauline Parker. They became fast friends, developing a strong bond that few understood, especially both sets of parents. Early in their friendship, Pauline and Juliet reportedly bonded over their childhood illnesses. They walked home from school together, did homework, and spent time together on weekends. They even vacationed with each other's families. In the beginning, the girls both had their own separate circle of school acquaintances. As time went on, the friendship evolved into an obsession. Pauline and Juliet were both deeply interested in writing, Together, they developed a rich fantasy life they referred to as the Fourth World. One by one, individual friends exited their lives. Pauline and Juliet spent hours walking arm in arm discussing the characters they'd created for books, films, and operas they wrote together. They often referred to these imaginary people as saints. A two-person cult would be the best way to describe Juliet and Pauline's attachment to one another. The girls built a temple on the Hume property, where they buried a dead mouse, complete with a tiny cross. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, other fake cemetery plots were created to symbolize the burial of their dead ideas. They planned to create their own Bible to capture their own concept of morality. The girls mocked traditional morals. They went as far as writing down the Ten Commandments to see how many they could break, which prompted a brief shoplifting stint. Pauline and Juliet spent every waking moment together and often slept beside one another. Neither girl could participate in sports at school or go to dances. Pauline's limp and Juliet's weak lungs made these activities impossible. Their imaginary world took the place of all other social engagements. They even came up with their own names. Juliet was Deborah, and Pauline was Gina or Jezebel. The names were used to write notes in code to each other, and Pauline often used them in her daily diary entries. When they were together, Pauline and Juliet became excited for a shared future. They planned to move to America and become famous writers. But over time, Pauline's parents began to blame her odd behavior on Juliet's bad influence, and Juliet's parents blamed Pauline for the change in their daughter. When their families tried to keep them apart, both Pauline and Juliet were despondent. At home, Pauline retreated to her bedroom and lost herself in solitude. Juliet, once outgoing and level-headed, grew moody and isolated herself. Both sets of parents were uncomfortable with the deep attachment the girls had formed. Dr. Hume began to suspect that Juliet was having a lesbian relationship with Pauline. He restricted their time together, which was met with rebellion. Juliet simply sneaked out, meeting her constant companion on the front lawn to perform moonlit dramatizations of their writings. Whether or not Juliet and Pauline were involved romantically or sexually remains uncertain. It's indisputable that their codependency made the girls panic over the thought of being apart. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, over time, the girls had retreated almost entirely to a tight little society populated by themselves and their fictional families. In this imagined reality, both Pauline and Juliet were beautiful and intelligent. More importantly, in their own world, they considered themselves superior to ordinary people in the real world. The first threat to their friendship arose out of the blue. In late 1953, an engineer named Walter Perry moved into a self-contained flat on the Hume estate. While Dr. Hume was lecturing at the university, Walter and Hilda Hume spent a lot of time together. It quickly became an illicit affair, but discretion was not Hilda's strong suit. Anytime Dr. Hume was out of town, Hilda escaped to the Port Levy cottage with Walter. The affair was exposed when Juliet caught Walter and her mother in bed together. Juliet kept her mother's secret, a decision that was made more out of concern for the impact on her friendship with Pauline than for the sake of preserving her parents' marriage. But Henry Hume was a deeply intelligent man. He was busy, but not oblivious. He suspected his wife's infidelity, and in 1954, the Humes began discussing divorce. It was decided that Dr. Hume would eventually return to England with their two children. First, they'd stop in South Africa for 3 months so Juliet could get treatment for her latest TB relapse. Hilda planned to create a whole new life with Walter in New Zealand. It likely wouldn't be in Christ Church, though. Dr. Hume had tarnished his and his wife's reputation by being on the wrong side of university politics. Plus, divorce in the 1950s was frowned upon among high society. It would be an understatement to say that Juliet and Pauline were devastated by these new plans. As the Sydney Morning Herald keenly observed, without each other, the artificial world that they had built, piece by piece like a castle of playing cards, would collapse. Pauline begged incessantly to go with Juliet to South Africa. Hilda didn't think it was a good idea, and both girls knew that Pauline's mother, Honora, would never allow it. In a manic frenzy, Juliet and Pauline came to an agreement. No matter what, they could not accept the idea of being separated. They had to stop it from happening. My dogs, Shadow and Clipper, bring me endless amounts of joy. After a long workday, they remind me to take a break and play. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes my boys are a little too good at getting into trouble. Maybe you can relate, so let me tell you about ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/murderish. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/murderish. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/murderish. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. On June 22, 1954, Honora Parker accompanied Juliet and Pauline on a walk around Victoria Park in Christchurch. The park, a popular picnic spot in town, overlooks a range of hills and provides breathtaking views of the Pacific Ocean. On the way to one of the walking paths, they stopped at a tea kiosk for refreshments. Half an hour later, the teenage girls returned to the kiosk in a panic. Agnes Ritchie, the woman working at the tea shop, later recalled to police that the girls had returned with their clothes and hands covered in blood. As quoted by the Birmingham Evening Mail, Pauline breathlessly told Mrs. Ritchie, "Mummy, she's terribly hurt. She slipped. I think she's dead." Mrs. Ritchie calmed the girls down and let them use her restroom to wash their hands. She then summoned the police. When officers arrived, they asked Juliet and Pauline to bring them to Pauline's mother. Pauline gave an account of Honora slipping on a plank on the path and then bumping her head repeatedly before her body went limp. An officer wrote down her statement and then drove both of the girls home. Dr. Pearson, a pathologist, arrived at Victoria Park to assess the scene and condition of Honora Parker's body. While the pathologist worked on his report, an officer found some disturbing items. A torn stocking was found nearby, its foot soaked in blood. Blood spatter stained other parts of the stocking. Less than 6 feet away, a piece of brick was found tossed into the trail brush. Bright red blood tinted the brick, indicating that the blood was fresh. Something didn't feel right to Dr. Pearson. As quoted by the Buffalo Courier-Express, The pathologist told the officer, almost 4 dozen separate head wounds, and I don't know how many fractures. This is murder. The weapon was the stocking with the brick in its foot. From the terrain, I'd say the woman was held prostrate on the ground while being assaulted. When the officer reminded the pathologist of the girl's account of what happened, Dr. Pearson encouraged a more thorough interview. Dr. Pearson was quoted as saying in the Buffalo Courier Express, "Maybe they saw the murder take place and are too frightened to tell the truth. Question them again." As reported by the Daily Telegraph, an autopsy revealed that Honora Parker had 45 wounds, including 24 lacerations, on the face and head. Some of her wounds were so deep they penetrated the bone. The assault on Mrs. Parker had been brutal and merciless. There was no doubt whoever had done this intended to kill her. The pressure weighed heavily on lead detective McDonald Brown to determine who could have wanted Mrs. Parker dead. The truth emerged quicker than they expected, and it stunned everyone. On the night of the alleged murder, Officer Brown called Pauline and Juliet to come in, at which time they were detained for further questioning. Without much coaxing, Pauline gave a full confession. In her statement to police, Pauline admitted that she hit her mother with a brick wrapped in a stocking which she had carried in a shoulder bag. According to the Birmingham Evening Mail, Pauline admitted, "As soon as I started to strike her, I regretted it, but I could not stop then." Juliet offered investigators a more detailed account. She referred to Honora as Mrs. Reaper in her initial statement, though in court proceedings, prosecutors insisted that Honora be referred to as Mrs. Parker, to make it clear that Pauline was the victim's daughter. According to the Birmingham Evening Mail, Juliet told Detective Brown, "On the way back along the track to the tea rooms, I was walking in front. I heard noises behind me. It was loud conversation and angry. I went back and saw Pauline hit Mrs. Reaper with the brick in the stocking. I took the stocking and hit her too. I was terrified. I thought one of them had to die. I wanted to help Pauline. It was terrible. Mrs. Reaper moved convulsively. We both held her until she was still when we left her. The brick had come out of the stocking with the force of the blows. I thought we may have been able to frighten Mrs. Reaper with the brick, and she would have then given her consent for Pauline and me to stay together. After the first blow, I knew it would be necessary for us to kill her. I was terrified and hysterical." Juliet's first statement implied the attack on Honora Parker's life had been impulsive. The next morning, she chose to be more candid. As quoted by the Daily Telegraph, Juliet revealed, "I left home with my father about 10:30 yesterday, with the brick wrapped in newspaper. After my father left me, I gave the brick to Pauline." Both Juliet and Pauline explained that Mrs. Parker had been a major obstacle in their plan to stay together. As soon as there was talk of Juliet leaving the country, they began hatching a plan to get rid of Pauline's mom. Detective Brown did not want to believe it. These girls came from good families, had high IQs, and were well-liked in their community, but there was nothing left to do but accept the truth. Especially after detectives located Pauline's diary during a search of her home. The girls were arrested 3 weeks later and charged with murder. At trial, Pauline's diary entries would be the star witness. The news of 45-year-old Honora Parker's merciless murder made international headlines. All of New Zealand was stunned. To this day, homicide is a rare occurrence in the island country. It was almost unthinkable that an unsuspecting woman could be slain in such a savage fashion. It was horrifying to consider the killers may have been Mrs. Parker's own daughter and her daughter's friend. Pauline's father would later testify at trial as a character witness. Juliet's father, the esteemed Dr. Henry Hume, left New Zealand hastily in mid-July 1954, taking his 10-year-old son with him. Dr. Hume dodged reporters as long as he could. He was finally tracked down on the ocean liner Himalaya, destined for his native England. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, Dr. Hume commented on the allegations against his daughter, Juliet, by saying, "The world will just have to think of me as an unnatural father. I cannot say why I decided to leave New Zealand at this time, but there is nothing I can do there just now. My only concern now is for my son. I want to spare him all I can. I've told him his sister is mentally ill, as indeed she is." It was the only comment Dr. Hume would ever make about the case to the press. British and international newspapers were unable to trace him ever again. Hilda Hume chose to remain in New Zealand and support her daughter Juliet in upcoming court proceedings. The highly publicized trial began at Christchurch District Court in mid-August 1954. Over the course of 6 days, Pauline Parker's diary entries were read aloud many times. One of the focal points of the sensational news coverage was the contrast in the girl's appearance. Juliet was frequently described as slim and pretty, with a pale complexion and gray eyes, who wore her long, fair brown hair hanging loosely around her shoulders. Pauline, on the other hand, was 2 inches shorter, with a closed-up, almost secretive look on her round, plumpish face, according to the Sydney Morning Herald. Juliet and Pauline both pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Their defense, Dr. Alex Haslam for Pauline Parker and Mr. T.A. Gresson for Juliet Hume, respectively, had to convince the jury that their clients were mentally ill and did not understand the ramifications of their actions. There was no question that the girls had committed the killing. Their own counsel acknowledged that. According to the Tennessean, Dr. Haslam explained the girls' perception by saying, they thought that by killing Mrs. Parker, they would achieve 2 things, send an unhappy woman to heaven and protect their paranoid delusions of grandeur. Crown Prosecutor Alan Brown insisted this had been a premeditated murder. According to the Tennessean, Brown stated that the slaying was committed by 2 dirty-minded girls who were sane at the time. They were not incurably insane, but incurably bad. Pauline's journal writings revealed her intent to kill. The Daily Telegraph chronicled the entries that were read aloud. February 13, 1954. Why couldn't mother die? Thousands are dying daily, so why not mother? April 28th. Anger against mother is boiling inside me, as she is the main obstacle in my path. Suddenly, means of ridding myself of obstacle occur to me if she was to die. June 20th. We discussed our plans for murdering mother and made them clear, but peculiarly enough, I have no qualms of conscience. June 21st, we decided to use a rock in a stocking rather than a sandbag. We discussed the moiter fully. The happy event is to take place tomorrow afternoon. The next time I write in my diary, mother will be dead. How odd, yet how pleasant. According to the Daily Telegraph, on June 22nd, Pauline wrote, "Day of happy event, felt very excited, and night before Christmassy last night. Didn't have pleasant dreams, though." The packed courtroom found the diary writings incredibly chilling. It proved that the girls had not only planned Honora Parker's murder, they'd celebrated it. Just like some criminals need a partner in crime to pull off their elaborate schemes, your business needs a reliable partner to elevate it to new heights. As the global commerce platform dedicated to supporting businesses at every stage of their journey, Shopify is your ultimate partner. Whether you're newly launching an online shop, transitioning to your first brick and mortar store, or hitting the did we just hit a million orders milestone, Shopify can help fuel your growth. With its all-encompassing e-commerce platform and seamless in-person POS system, Shopify has your back no matter what or where you're selling. Shopify is committed to turning casual browsers into committed buyers, boasting the internet's best converting checkout, a staggering 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star, streamlines your efforts to sell more with less hassle. Once I started hitting milestones with Murderish, I realized I needed more support to fuel my growing business. What I love about Shopify is that no matter how big you want to grow your business, Shopify has all the tools you need to take your business to the next level. Fueling 10% of total e-commerce in the United States, Shopify is the driving force behind major players like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, as well as countless entrepreneurs spanning 175 countries. Businesses that thrive, thrive with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/murderish, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/murderish now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/murderish.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Nothing is more annoying than having an exciting day planned only to wake up to bad allergies. First world problems, I know, but sometimes allergies ruin my entire day. If you suffer from allergies, I know you understand my struggle. No one wants to go through the day sounding like they're talking underwater. Luckily, we have Astapro. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. Between my daughter's school events, Zoom meetings, and podcast recording sessions, I don't have time to deal with allergy issues. And who wants to listen to a podcast when I sound like this? Luckily, you don't have to, because I use Astapro for quick and effective relief. You're welcome. Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Pauline and Juliet remain stoic throughout the 6-day trial. According to The Age, the only display of emotion came from Pauline when a 1953 entry about sneaking out to be intimate with a boyfriend was read before the court. It had little to do with the case, and it felt like a true violation of privacy. In response, Pauline scrunched up her face in anger. Both defense attorneys had an uphill battle, given how incriminating Pauline's diary entries were. Each defense attorney called forth psychiatrists to testify. Dr. R.V. Medlicott told the court that the girls had their own standards of morality and hadn't considered it wrong to kill Mrs. Parker, just like they hadn't viewed shoplifting as immoral. As quoted by the Evening Post, Dr. Medlicott said, "They considered they were quite unique geniuses with their own paradise and could do exactly as they liked. It was quite right for them to indulge in shoplifting and to steal, because they were merely raising money to further their own plans." Under cross-examination, the doctor admitted the girls most likely would not have killed Mrs. Parker if a policeman had been nearby. In his opinion, Juliet and Pauline were not sane. They had conceptualized their own sinister fantasy world, devised their own religion, and conjured their own god. According to the Evening Post, he said, "Their God was a more powerful one than the human version." After Dr. Medlicott's testimony, prosecutor Alan Brown posed a question to the jury. Were the girls insane from a legal point of view? That's what needed to be carefully considered to reach a verdict. Doctors testifying for the prosecution aimed to prove that Juliet and Pauline were lucid and mentally sound when they concocted the plot to kill Pauline's mother. One doctor after another concluded that Pauline and Juliet had been sane before, during, and after the crime. In their professional opinions, the girls understood their actions were wrong in the eyes of the law and the community, and chose to assault Honora Parker anyway. All that mattered to them was getting what they wanted. Mr. T.A. Gresson, Juliet's lawyer, attempted to shift the blame to the girls' parents. They were minors, after all. Gresson tried to convince jurors that either set of parents could have prevented Honora's death. As quoted by the Sydney Morning Herald, Gresson asked jurors rhetorically, "I suppose some of you have daughters. If any of them showed half the symptoms which these two showed, do you mean to say you wouldn't send for a doctor?" In an effort to gain sympathy for her daughter, Hilda Hume took the stand to speak about Juliet's early years. Juliet was a sensitive and lonely child who suffered trauma from being raised in wartime England. As reported by the Birmingham Evening Mail, one afternoon, Mrs. Hume was caught in an air raid with Juliet, who was barely two. As a result, Juliet suffered from bomb shock and had terrifying nightmares for many years. This emotional upheaval was compounded by her contracting TB and being sent away multiple times for treatment. The separation from her family had produced further trauma. On August 28, 1954, the all-male jury reached a verdict after 2 hours of deliberation. They rejected the insanity defense plea and found Juliet Hume and Pauline Parker guilty of murder. This made the best friends the youngest individuals convicted of murder in New Zealand at the time. Because they were both younger than 18, their crime was not punishable by death. If two adult women had murdered Mrs. Parker, they would have been executed by hanging. Justice Adams ordered that they be detained during Her Majesty's pleasure. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, this sentence meant they were to be detained at the discretion of the Minister of Justice. They could each serve only 5 years, or as many as 25 years. As reported by The Age, there was a calamitous uproar in the crowded public gallery when the verdict was shared. As Juliet was escorted away, her mother squeezed her eyes shut and clenched her hands into tight fists. A van was backed up to the doorway of the courthouse dock so the convicted girls could escape the frenzy of spectators and cameras. The outcome Juliet and Pauline had always feared came true. They were separated. The trial was the last time they ever saw one another. Pauline Parker was initially sent to a prison near Christchurch to carry out her sentence. After a few months, she was transferred to Orohata Women's Reformatory near Wellington, which was equivalent to a low-security juvenile detention center. While incarcerated, Pauline completed a year-long curriculum under the government's correspondence school and earned a high school graduation certificate. She also converted to Roman Catholicism and found peace in studying her new religion. Though she was sentenced to indefinite incarceration, Pauline spent roughly 6 years in prison before being released on parole in late 1959. Pauline was given a new identity as Hillary Nathan, but remained closely monitored by law enforcement. She earned a Bachelor of Arts degree at Auckland University, where she trained to be a librarian. She worked for a brief time at a library in Wellington. Her parole was lifted in 1965. As soon as she was permitted to leave, Pauline relocated to England. She opted for a career change, settling down in Kent, England, where she spent her career teaching special needs children and running a children's horseback riding school. Though she consistently dodged the press, in 1996, Pauline released a public statement through her sister, Wendy, expressing deep remorse for her actions. As quoted by New Zealand Woman's Weekly, Wendy commented, "Pauline committed the most terrible crime and has spent 40 years repaying it by keeping away from people and doing her own thing." As of April 2023, the Daily Mail reported that 85-year-old Pauline Parker was hospitalized near her home on Scotland's remote Orkney Islands. It's unknown if she passed away around that time. After the trial, Hilda Hume saw no other choice but to distance herself from her daughter Juliet's conviction as much as possible. She legally changed her name to H. Marion Perry and married her paramour, Walter Perry. They left for England shortly after. During her incarceration, Juliet became the only child inmate at Mount Eden's Women Prison in Auckland. It was a horrific place where the country's hanging executions were carried out. According to The Guardian, Juliet said the prison was supposedly the toughest in the Southern Hemisphere. As reported by the New Zealand Herald, Juliet spent the first 3 months of her sentence in solitary confinement. Then she was forced to perform hard labor, but her lung issues led to physical collapse. A fellow inmate took mercy on her and taught her how to sew prison uniforms, a task much more bearable for Juliet. After serving 5.5 years at Mount Eden, Juliet was released without parole supervision in late 1959. A few days after her release, she joined her mother and her stepfather, Walter, in England. Juliet Hume legally changed her name to Anne Perry, adopting her stepfather's surname. She took on a series of jobs, first as a flight attendant, then as a buyer for a department store, and finally as a property underwriter, according to the press. Bouncing between jobs gave Anne more time to write. She chose a topic very familiar to her, murder. In 1979, Anne Perry published her first novel, The Cater Street Hangman. Over the next 15 years, she sold more than 26 million books worldwide, according to the Edmonton Journal. Anne Perry's novels and novellas featured historical murder mysteries that landed her on the New York Times bestseller list regularly. No one suspected Anne was writing from personal experience until 1994, with the release of Peter Jackson's Oscar-nominated film, Heavenly Creatures, that year. The media eventually uncovered the truth. Juliet Hume was best-selling novelist Anne Perry. Journalists managed to track down Anne in a remote fishing village in Scotland. After her identity was publicly outed, Anne told The Guardian, "It seemed so unfair. Everything I had worked to achieve as a decent member of society was threatened. And once again, my life was being interpreted by someone else. It happened in court when, as a minor, I wasn't allowed to speak, and I heard all these lies being told. And now, there was a film, but nobody had bothered to talk to me. I knew nothing about it until the day before release. All I could think of was that my life would fall apart and that it might kill my mother." Anne has maintained that she was coerced into the murder that changed her life. She claimed Pauline had threatened to harm herself if she didn't help her. Out of a sense of misguided loyalty, she succumbed to Pauline's manipulation. In 2017, Anne Perry moved to Los Angeles so she could be involved in film adaptations of her novels. She never married out of fear that her past would not be accepted. For many years, she lived with her retired brother, who worked as a research assistant for her published works. Anne Perry died on April 10, 2023, at the age of 84, due to complications from a heart attack. Her final novel, The Fourth Enemy, was published the day after her passing. Her novels continue to be enjoyed by crime enthusiasts, some of whom are unaware of the chilling connection between the author and her works of fiction. Anne's firsthand experience with killing likely made her characters as realistic as possible, but it cost a human life. In a 2006 interview with the New Zealand Herald, Anne made it known she believed people can change, saying, "In a sense, it's not a matter at the end of judging. It's in the end, who am I? Am I somebody that can be trusted? Am I someone that is compassionate, gentle, patient, strong? If you're that kind of person, if you've done something bad in the past, you've obviously changed. It's who you are when time's up that matters." Many crime historians have theorized the murder of Honora Parker would never have happened if Pauline and Juliet had never met. It's difficult to say if either young girl would have ever committed such violence without each other's influence. People often say hindsight is 20/20, but even today, there isn't full clarity on this case. We can guess whether the crime would have happened if the two girls never met each other, but we can never know for certain. We can also theorize who may have been more culpable. It seems Pauline may have suffered more profoundly than Juliet, but that's just conjecture. Despite it all, Anne Perry Juliet managed to see the success that she and Pauline had always dreamed of achieving. And to that fact, I ask, would Anne Perry Juliet have become a successful writer without the horrific crime she committed in her past? Thank you for listening to Murderish. Make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening to Murderish right now, so you don't miss any new episodes. If you enjoy Murderish, please consider leaving a 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now. I'll be on Podcast Row at CrimeCon from May 31st to June 2nd, 2024. The event is in Nashville this year. If you're planning to attend CrimeCon 2024, use code MURDERISH at checkout for 10% off a standard badge. CrimeCon is always a great time, and I've been attending for 6 years now. It never disappoints. Use code MURDERISH for a 10% discount on a standard badge. Hope to see you there. Are you watching a lot of true crime documentaries and want a community of like-minded people to talk about them with? Join the True Crime TV Club I started. We call ourselves the Serial Streamers, and we meet in my Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube comments a couple times a month to dish about all the crazy true crime documentaries we're watching together. If you want to join Serial Streamers, all you have to do is follow me on Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube at Jamie On Air. That's J-A-M-I On Air. And then just watch for videos about the latest TV series we're watching together so you can join us in the comments and share your thoughts. I also do a recap of all the documentaries we watch together on Murderish. A couple Fridays a month, new Serial Streamers episodes are released on Murderish, the podcast, and on my YouTube channel. I'm at Jamie On Air on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube if you'd like to join the community. This episode was researched and written by Allison Schwartz. Visit murderish.com for a list of sources used for this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and remember, listening to this podcast doesn't make you a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish. All right, Murderish listeners, I need your help with another missing person case. 12-year-old Lori Page has been missing from Tallahassee, Florida since June 3rd of 2023. She's African-American with brown eyes and black hair, which she wore in dreads during her last sighting. Lori is 5 feet tall and weighs about 120 pounds. In addition to Tallahassee, Lori is known to frequent Tampa, Florida, Thomasville, Georgia, and Nashville, Tennessee. The FBI is offering a $15,000 reward for information leading to the recovery of the missing girl. Anyone with information on Lori Page's disappearance should contact the FBI's Jacksonville field office at 904-248-7000 or the Tallahassee Police Department at 850-891-4200.